Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Paul Townsend, the host of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real courtroom drama. And the good news today, listeners, is that I have been listening to you. Some of the feedback I've been getting is that people want me to cover more current topics, things that are happening right now in the legal world. Now, I have consciously shied away a bit from covering the most current of current events, and there's a reason for that. As events unfold, especially high-profile legal events in this country, they're often covered through political lenses. This is not a political commentary show. If you're looking for a political commentary show, I'm happy to make recommendations, but I never want this podcast to be about red team, blue team issues. And it is much easier to critique lawyers' performances and strategies in the past rather than now, because I run the risk of getting called a partisan hack if I say something negative about a current Department of Justice lawyer. Conversely, I run the risk of being called a partisan hack if I say something complimentary about a current Department of Justice lawyer. So you can see my dilemma. But people want it, and I do want to try to tailor the show's content towards what people are actually interested in, and I do invite people to give me recommendations or ideas. So we'll give this a shot together and cover facts without bias. I will repeat again, because I know that listeners of this show will have their own political leanings, and I firmly believe everyone is entitled to their own political preferences, but In Summation is not a forum for political ideology. If you want to email me after listening and discuss political philosophy, hey, I'm game. But I can assure everyone listening that my own personal political feelings do not bleed into my analysis, and if anything I say leads you to believe they are, that is unintentional, and I apologize. My goal is, at the end of the podcast, you have absolutely no idea where I fall on the politics of all this, but you do have an understanding of the case, the arguments, the decisions, and the outcomes. Phew. Okay, disclaimer completed. Let's get to the interesting part of the show. The reason that I had to go on that protracted diatribe is that today we are discussing the bizarre prosecution of Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. If you're politically active or have strong feelings about politics, chances are you have strong feelings about Michael Flynn. I do not think I need to spend a great deal of time on Flynn's background. He was born on Christmas Eve, 1958, in Rhode Island. He served some time in juvenile detention in his youth for what he himself described as, quote, serious and unlawful activity, end quote. These records have since been expunged. He attended the University of Rhode Island and earned a 1.2 GPA his freshman year. But his life turned around his sophomore year. He was awarded a 3-year scholarship by the ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps, which led him to stay enrolled in school rather than drop out. He graduated as a distinguished military graduate of the ROTC. He was commissioned in the Army in military intelligence in 1981. He rose in the ranks steadily and became the Director of Intelligence for the Joint Special Operations Command from July 2004 to June 2007 in Afghanistan and Iraq. He became Director of Intelligence for all of the United States Central Command from June 2007 to July 2008. In 2012, President Obama made Flynn the Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. This post has a 2-year appointment. Between 2012 and 2014, Flynn struggled to ingratiate himself to his colleagues. He was frequently considered insubordinate by his superiors, and those under him felt his management style was chaotic and difficult to follow. So his 2-year term was not extended. Flynn clashed heavily with the Obama administration on Syria, Al-Qaeda, and Al-Nusra. He gave interviews to Al Jazeera in which he claimed the Obama administration was not doing enough in the Middle East to prevent the exportation of terrorism. He retired from military service on August 7, 2014. And with his newfound free time, he started the Flynn Intel Group with his son, Michael Flynn. Flynn Intel provided intelligence services for businesses and governments. The company received about $65,000 from companies connected to Russia in 2015. In summer 2016, Flynn was very vocal in his opposition to Turkish President Recep Erdogan and supported a coup that had arisen to oust him. But in September 2016, Flynn's consulting company was hired by Inovo BV, a company with deep ties to Erdogan. Inovo paid Flynn Intel $530,000 for lobbying work. And among other things, Flynn wrote an op-ed backing and praising Ergenon's government, which was published on Election Day 2016. Flynn Intel then closed shop in late 2016. As we all know, the case with Michael Flynn revolved around his relationship with Russia. Here are the key facts which highlight the Flynn-Russia ties. Flynn was paid around $5,000 to serve as a consultant to a joint U.S.-Russian project to build nuclear reactors in the Middle East. At a gala dinner in Moscow in 2015, Flynn was seated directly next to Vladimir Putin, a situation which apparently startled some U.S. officials, according to journalist Michael Crowley of Politico. As part of the gala, Flynn gave a talk on world affairs, for which he was paid around $45,000. Although nothing happened directly after this gala, the circumstances of Flynn's presence at this event definitely registered with certain members of U.S. intelligence and the State Department. Then the 2016 election gets in full swing. Flynn is consulted by a number of the Republican candidates on national security issues. He's even vetted by Donald Trump to be a potential running mate, despite being registered as a Democrat. Now, clearly, President Trump selected Indiana Governor Mike Pence to be his running mate, and not Michael Flynn. But once Trump won the election, he did intend to make Flynn a part of his administration. By now, Flynn had earned himself a reputation in Washington, D.C. President Trump seemed to like Flynn's vocal opposition to the Obama administration's Middle East policies, but it seems that President Trump may have been one of the few. Even his own transition team, led by former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, opposed Trump's decision to make Flynn national security advisor. President Obama himself supposedly warned Trump against putting him in that role a few days before the selection was made public. Trump announced Flynn as his pick for national security advisor on November 18, 2016. Around 6 weeks later, on January 4, 2017, Flynn notified Chris Christie and the rest of the transition team that he was under investigation for secret lobbying work he had done for Turkey during the campaign. President Trump would later complain that President Obama should have told him about the ongoing investigation, and that had he known, he never would have put Flynn in that role. That may have saved America from the circus of the Flynn prosecution, but only because he would never have been national security advisor. The investigation into his dealings with Turkey fizzled out, and it was his role in dealings with Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak which resulted in a multi-year legal debacle. Flynn had known Kislyak since 2013, when Kislyak coordinated Flynn's trip to Moscow as part of his work with the Defense Intelligence Agency. Flynn and Kislyak didn't have too much direct contact for a while after that, but once Trump won the election and selected him as national security advisor in late November, there was a meeting between Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and advisor, and Kislyak. Flynn was asked to join the meeting. Kislyak was hoping to discuss America's policy in Syria, but they were unable to connect over a secure channel, so the substantive part of that meeting never took place. There were, however, several phone calls between Flynn and Kislyak in late December of 2016 and early January of 2017. The United Nations Security Council was contemplating a resolution condemning Israeli settlements in Palestine. Flynn was asking Russia to oppose the resolution. Ultimately, Russia did not oppose the resolution. On December 29, 2016, President Obama announced that due to Russian interference in the election, the United States was going to retaliate against Russia with certain measures. Included in those measures was the expulsion of 35 suspected Russian intelligence agents. Now, incoming President Trump was concerned that Russia would escalate a response in the weeks before he took office, and his ability to build any relationship with Russia would be damaged prior to him even taking office. The same day that the measures were announced, Flynn called Kislyak and asked that Russia only respond with a reciprocal response and not to escalate the situation. Flynn spoke both with his deputy national security advisors and the Trump transition team both before and after the call. On December 31st, Kislyak called Flynn to inform him that Putin had agreed to his request and would not retaliate against the United States. And here's where things start to derail for Flynn. On January 12, 2017, The Washington Post ran a story publicizing that Flynn had made the December 29th call to Kislyak and alleging that Flynn, and by proxy the new Trump administration in general, had done something to undercut the sanctions imposed by the Obama administration. Now, on its face, this was a valid question to be asking. The State Department was shocked that Russia had not retaliated at all to the sanctions, and U.S. intelligence agencies monitor the calls of the Russian ambassador, so they knew that Flynn had called him. It was not unreasonable to wonder whether some side agreement had been reached. Flynn summoned his deputy national security advisor, K.T. McFarland, and instructed him to respond to the Washington Post article and say that sanctions were absolutely not discussed in his phone call. Clearly, this was not true. McFarland knows this is not true. But McFarland goes to the Washington Post anyway, and they print the story of Flynn's denial. Flynn also tells Chief of Staff Reince Priebus that he didn't discuss sanctions with Kislyak. Then he told Press Secretary Sean Spicer the same thing. Then Vice President Pence, who also repeated the lie to the media, though at least Pence didn't find out that the information wasn't true until much later. The director of the FBI at the time, Jim Comey, was concerned about Flynn's relationship with Russia and wanted to interview him. Comey's deputy, Andrew McCabe, called Flynn and asked him to meet with two counterintelligence agents. Flynn agreed. Flynn also declined to invite a lawyer to be present for the interview. I'm going to pause here for a second because a lot of ink has been spilled over Flynn's lack of an attorney at this meeting. Ardent Flynn supporters claim that he was told this was a routine interview, that he didn't need an attorney, and he shouldn't have one. They claim this was a way to trap Flynn without having the protection of counsel there. Flynn detractors, on the other hand, claim that McCabe told him he was able to have a lawyer, and he simply declined. That conversation is really useless and doesn't really matter at all in the end. All you really need to know is that, one, Flynn had a right to have a lawyer there. Had he requested one, he absolutely would have had one. And two, Flynn did not request one, so he did not have one. And ultimately, I really don't know if the presence of a lawyer at this meeting would have really had any effect on the way things turned out. At the interview, the two agents ask Flynn whether he tried to influence Russia's position on the UN resolution on Israeli settlements in Palestine. Flynn claimed unequivocally that he did not. In reality, he did. They also asked him whether he had asked Kislyak to avoid escalating the diplomatic conflict. Flynn again says he did not. Again, he did. And the reason that we know this is that the Mueller report, that gargantuan tome, actually contains the agent's notes from the interview in what's called an FBI 302. It's called an FBI 302 simply because 302 is the form number which appears on the document, similar to an IRS 1040 or 1099. In essence, any time an FBI agent does something in an official capacity and has to write a report on it, they use the FBI 302 form to chronicle their activity. This case, the FBI 302 author was Agent Peter Strzok. In order to really understand how the legal case against Flynn progressed, you have to understand what he actually did that was illegal. So much of the media coverage has been about the fact that he called Kislyak and spoke to him about national matters. That's not illegal. That's common for incoming security advisors. Jake Sullivan, who is President-elect Joe Biden's national security advisor, is definitely on the phone with foreign nationals discussing U.S. policy and the goals of the incoming Biden administration. This is part of the role of the National Security Advisor. Partisan journalists and reporters have been citing the Logan Act as a potential way to prosecute Flynn for years. So, let me explain the Logan Act in a few quick sentences. The Logan Act is a law passed in 1799. Which forbids unauthorized American citizens from interfering in disputes or controversies between the United States and foreign governments. A grand total of two people have ever been indicted under the Logan Act. In 1803, a Kentucky farmer named Francis Flournoy advocated for the creation of a new state, not a part of the U.S., who would ally with France. In so doing, Flournoy had attempted to contact the French government. Recall that in 1803, the Louisiana Purchase had not yet occurred, so French territory was directly west of Kentucky. Flournoy was only indicted. He was never actually prosecuted. The case was dropped when the Louisiana Purchase actually took place. The second indictment took place in 1852, when a sailor named Jonas Phillips Levy, an American living in Mexico, acquired a grant to build a railway across Mexico, while Secretary of State Daniel Webster was simultaneously negotiating for a different railway to be built. Levy wrote a letter directly to the Mexican president, urging him to reject Webster's proposal. He was also indicted but not prosecuted, but only because federal prosecutors could not obtain a copy of the letter from the Mexican president, and without it, they had no direct evidence of his offense. So that's it. 221 years, two indictments, zero prosecutions. And it's because of the word unauthorized. Flynn, as incoming National Security Advisor, was authorized to speak on behalf of the United States. So please, ignore any nonsense about Flynn violating the Logan Act. It's just wrong, and people suggest that he be prosecuted for it really don't understand what they're saying. Instead, Flynn violated a specific provision in the federal code which prohibits lying to federal agents in connection with a federal matter. In the United States, you cannot lie to an FBI agent during a formal interview. It's against the law. On February 9th, 2017, the Washington Post ran a story alleging Flynn had lied previously when he denied discussing sanctions. The story cited nine current and former officials who claimed to have reviewed a transcript of Flynn's call with Kislyak and confirmed that sanctions were discussed. Flynn originally tried to walk back his denial, but on February 13, 2017, Flynn resigned. He had held the position of National Security Advisor for all of 24 days. Now, unless you're a pretty keen follower of fact-based, reputable news sources, this is probably where you start to lose a full grasp on what happened to Flynn. So here's how the legal issues developed. Flynn had two main issues he was simultaneously combating. First, obviously, is that he was caught lying to federal agents in a formal interview, which we now know is a crime. The second was that he and his son were being investigated for the Flynn Intel Group's activities. There are strict disclosure rules when you lobby on behalf of foreign powers, and the allegation was that Flynn Intel had not always been so thorough on making the appropriate filings and declaring their earnings. Flynn was adamant that his son be left alone, so his lawyers were able to strike a deal with Robert Mueller's team where Flynn would plead guilty to willfully and knowingly making false and fraudulent statements to the FBI. In return, the Flynn Intel Group investigation would fade away. On December 1, 2017, Flynn enters his guilty plea and promised full cooperation with the Mueller investigation. At the time, the case was before the Honorable Rudolph Contreras, a federal district court judge for the District of Columbia. Let's take a brief moment here and discuss how sentencing works in federal court. Contrary to what you see on TV and in the movies, in the federal court system, a prosecutor does not call the defense attorney and make an offer of 5 years if the defendant agrees to plead guilty. The actual sentence is almost never a negotiated amount of time between the U.S. Attorney's Office and defense counsel. Sentencing is at the discretion of the judge. Once a person pleads guilty, they are interviewed by the Department of Probation, who drafts a report and provides it to the parties and the judge. Probation makes a recommendation as to where the defendant falls in the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines. These guidelines are an incredibly complex system of determining the range of recommended incarceration. They're essentially based on the type of crime, the harm, to the extent that that is quantifiable, and the person's past criminal history. The defense attorney submits what they believe the appropriate guidelines to be, the prosecutor submits their theory, and probation gives their opinion. The federal sentencing guidelines used to be mandatory, meaning that the judge was required to sentence somewhere in the range that the guidelines computed, but that's no longer the case. Now they're used as a blueprint, but a judge can go above the top of the guidelines range if he or she feels that there were aggravating circumstances which need to be taken into account. Or alternatively, if the judge feels that there's mitigation to consider, they can go under the guidelines range. Generally speaking, after a person pleads guilty in federal court, The sentencing is typically scheduled for around 2 to 3 months later to give all parties enough time to submit what they need to aid the judge in coming to a fair sentence. Michael Flynn pleaded guilty on December 1st, 2017, but 6 days later, Judge Contreras recused himself, which means he voluntarily decided to remove himself as the judge on the case. The reason is that he was very familiar with Peter Strzok, the agent who conducted the interview where Flynn had just admitted to lying. The case was then reassigned to the Honorable Judge Emmett Sullivan, who most people associate with this case. It does happen from time to time that a party will request an extension for a substantive court appearance, such as a sentencing. And Flynn's sentencing was delayed, and then delayed again, and again, and again. The likely reason for this is Flynn's cooperation with the Mueller probe. When a criminal defendant agrees to cooperate in an active investigation, they will plead guilty, but the sentencing will not take place until essentially there's no further need for them to cooperate. In that way, the prosecutor can ensure that the person remains cooperative. If they're sentenced right away, then there is no further incentive for the defendant to provide more information or even show up to meetings. But if the defendant believes that they will only receive a benefit in sentencing if they continue to do what is asked of them, it acts as a sort of Damocles over their heads. Flynn was scheduled for sentencing by Judge Sullivan on December 18, 2018. His attorneys at the time, the law firm of Covington and Burling, claimed to Judge Sullivan the FBI agents had tricked Flynn into being interviewed without a lawyer and had not told him that lying to them was a crime. Judge Sullivan, a Clinton appointee, has a noted skepticism of government conduct. He ordered that the documents related to the interview be provided to him. But when Flynn appeared in front of Judge Sullivan on December 18, 2018, he was severely castigated by the judge. Sullivan gave Flynn the option to continue his cooperation or to accept a sentence right then and there. But he made it clear that he felt that Flynn had, quote, sold your country out, end quote, and strongly hinted that there would be a period of incarceration imposed if he were to proceed to sentencing right then and there. Flynn agreed to deter his sentencing further in an attempt to rack up some more cooperation points to support his request for probation. Judge Sullivan asked Flynn's attorney, Robert Kellner, whether he was claiming on the record right then and there that Flynn had been entrapped. Kellner said he was not. Sullivan then asked Flynn, under oath, if he wanted to withdraw his guilty plea and go to trial. Flynn reiterated his guilty plea and stated that he knew that lying to the agents was a crime at the time he did it. Satisfied, Judge Sullivan agreed to delay the sentencing. In June of 2019, Flynn fired Covington and Burling and hired Sidney Powell, a woman now associated with the claim that she was on the verge of unleashing the kraken of evidence of election fraud in the 2020 presidential election, as attorney for the Trump administration. We'll save that scenario for another episode. At the time, Sidney Powell was a very effective and respected defense attorney. Powell's strategy was to try to withdraw Flynn's guilty plea. In August of 2019, Powell filed a motion to hold the prosecutors in contempt for malevolent conduct. She accused them of withholding material information which would have benefited Flynn's case and impacted his decision on whether to plead guilty. A subsequent October 2019 filing accused the FBI agents of entrapment. Judge Sullivan dutifully weighed the merits of Powell's motions and then tossed them out. He reset the sentencing date for January 28, 2020. Sullivan also invited the prosecution team to submit a new sentencing recommendation. They had previously advocated for little or no jail time for Flynn, but Sullivan wanted to give them the opportunity to change that position if they desired. The prosecutors proposed a sentence of 6 months jail. On January 7th, now 3 weeks before his sentencing date, Powell filed a motion to withdraw Flynn's guilty plea. Withdrawing a guilty plea is a very hard thing to do. When a criminal defendant decides to plead guilty, they go in front of a judge, they are placed under oath, they are asked a series of questions. The judge has to make sure that the person is pleading guilty voluntarily. No one has made any side deals or promises with him, that he understands his rights to a trial and to cross-examine witnesses who testify against him, and the person has to state under oath what they did to violate the law they are pleading guilty to. So they swear, under the penalties of perjury, that they did the conduct which they are accused of, and explicitly tell the court how they did it. This whole line of questions and allocution are put in place so that a defendant cannot later claim that he did not understand what was going on, or that he did not know that he had rights that he was waiving. The result is that showing that a guilty plea violated someone's constitutional rights, and thus it should be withdrawn, is a very, very high bar. But in this case, Powell really had no choice. She knows Judge Sullivan is not overly sympathetic to Flynn. She was hired after he had pleaded guilty, so she never had an opportunity to stop him from doing that. She knows the prosecutors are now requesting incarceration. The only option she has is to try to withdraw his plea. The reason she cites in her motion is that the government acted in bad faith, was vindictive, and breached their obligations under the plea agreement. Flynn then filed a declaration with the court, under oath, that he was innocent, that he still didn't remember whether he had discussed sanctions with Kislyak or the details of any conversation he had about the resolution concerning Israeli settlements. He claimed he did not consciously or intentionally lie, and he also claimed that he had not received the effective assistance of counsel by Covington and Burling, and that he was induced into pleading guilty because of their mistakes. So now, in addition to lying to the FBI agents, Flynn has committed perjury. He has twice, on the record, under oath, indicated that he willfully and knowingly lied to FBI agents in his interview. Now he has stated, under oath, that he did no such thing. By now, the case had become a circus, and every motion and every court appearance was getting national attention. Flynn had a new sentencing date of February 27th, 2020. A few days before Flynn was set to appear for sentencing, for what feels like the 40th time, Attorney General Bill Barr appointed Jeffrey Jensen, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Missouri, to review Flynn's case. Flynn's sentencing was adjourned indefinitely to allow both sides to prepare legal arguments on Flynn's claim that he had previously received ineffective assistance of counsel. Jensen finished his review and recommended to Bill Barr that the charges be dropped. Barr agreed, and the Department of Justice filed a motion to drop the charges on May 7, 2020. In the motion, the Department of Justice claimed that the questioning of Flynn was, quote, untethered to and unjustified by the FBI's counterintelligence investigation, end quote. In essence, what the U.S. Attorney's Office was saying was that since they had no basis to even interview Flynn, that any illegal conduct which took place as a result of that interview should be ignored. The statute criminalizes lying to FBI agents who are acting in an official capacity. What the government was saying in their motion here is that because there was no reason to interview Flynn, the agents cannot be considered to have been acting in an official capacity, and thus lying to them does not violate the statute. While on its face, this argument has technical legal merit, I don't fault anyone for coming to the conclusion that President Trump, who is vocally supportive of Flynn on Twitter, may have instructed Bill Barr to drop the case. I have no proof of that, and as I've said before, I do try not to deal in rank speculation. And all I'm saying is that when people voice that opinion, I tend not to push back too hard, even though I have never seen a shred of evidence to support its veracity. But for whatever reason, the prosecution team filed a motion to drop the charges. And that should be the end, right? Well, not in this case. Because a motion is technically a request for the judge to rule a certain way. It is still up to the judge whether to grant or reject the motion, even if the other side does not oppose it or even joins in it. And this is what really created the confusing legal issue of the Flynn case. Judge Sullivan did not grant the motion. Instead, he invited third-party groups to be heard on the issue. He appointed U.S. District Judge John Gleason to file a third-party brief in opposition to the government's motion and to weigh in on what should be done about Flynn's clear perjury. Gleason's brief recommended against dropping the case and claimed that the reasons cited by the Department of Justice were pretextual, and that there was a clear abuse of prosecutorial power. Gleason further concluded that Flynn had indeed committed perjury, and that this should be taken into account during his sentencing. In response, the Department of Justice filed a supplemental brief claiming that even if Gleason's findings were accurate and there was a gross abuse of power, the U.S. Attorney's Office still retained the authority to drop a case without the need for judicial authorization. Take a step back and consider the arguments that are going on now. The prosecutor has a defendant who has already pleaded guilty twice. He has admitted his guilt on the record. The defendant then files a motion to withdraw that guilty plea. In response, the prosecution moves to drop the charges themselves, and the judge, instead of dropping the charges, appoints an independent third-party judge to argue against dropping the charges. That judge says dropping the charges is an abuse of power, and the prosecutor's response is, well, so what? We can do it anyway. This is truly unheard of. A prosecutor trying to drop a case and being prevented from doing so. This interaction was mostly between Bill Barr's Justice Department and Judge Sullivan and Judge Gleason. So now Sidney Powell gets involved. She filed an emergency appeal to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, essentially asking them to force Judge Sullivan to grant the motion and drop the charges. A three-judge panel on the Court of Appeals takes up the case in June 2020. They hear argument from Powell, the Department of Justice, and from Judge Sullivan via teleconference, as the COVID pandemic was in full swing by June. The panel orders Sullivan to grant the motion and dismiss the charges. So now, this must be over, right? The Court of Appeals has weighed in and ruled that the Department of Justice has the authority to drop a prosecution if they determine they wish to do so. But it doesn't end here. Judge Sullivan files an appeal to have the entire panel of the Court of Appeals hear the case rather than just the three judges. The entire panel agrees, and a new hearing is scheduled. Powell, the Department of Justice, and Judge Sullivan again appear by teleconference, this time in mid-August, and the panel rules that Sullivan does not have to dismiss the case. The original three-judge panel had ruled 2-1 in favor of dismissing the case, but when the full 10-judge panel voted, the vote came down 8-2 in favor of not dismissing the case. Being a district court judge, Emmett Sullivan probably knew that the panel in general was likely to rule in his favor, and was probably extremely discouraged when he heard who the three panelists were when the case was initially assigned. The two judges who ruled against him, Naomi Rao and Karen Henderson, were the only two judges in the entire circuit who voted against him, so getting a full panel to hear him became essential. After all the drama, Flynn was given a presidential pardon on November 25th, 2020, which finally put the issue to bed. In summation, this case highlights a very real and very interesting issue in the criminal justice system. The U.S. Attorney's Office is the representative of the executive branch. This is the wing of government which is in charge of ensuring that people follow the laws and prosecuting people who break them. Judge Sullivan, as a member of the judiciary, is supposed to ensure that both sides of a court case are playing fairly, to assess the legal arguments made by each party, and make determinations about what the law is applied to specific facts of the case. It is up to the prosecutor to decide who to charge. Judges don't make those decisions. But what about the decision not to charge? I'll give you my opinion on the merits of the legal arguments each side made here. The Department of Justice's claim that, abuse of power or not, they are the branch of government who decides who to prosecute and who not to, is ultimately correct. I do not think it is appropriate for a judge to essentially try to force a prosecution. This is simply not an appropriate function of the judicial branch. That being said, I am very sympathetic to Judge Sullivan's arguments in this particular case. Flynn had already pleaded guilty. He was simply awaiting sentencing. In Judge Sullivan's mind, that meant that the decision on whether to prosecute or not was over, and the only determination left was related to sentencing, which is very much a function of the judiciary. And the reason I cannot fully get on board with that argument is that in the intervening time period between the guilty plea and the sentence, there are still prosecutorial functions taking place, Flynn's cooperation being the biggest example. There were still things that Flynn was doing which impacted how the prosecution was going to treat him. And to me, that highlights that the executive branch is still the dominant player in the decision to prosecute even after a guilty plea. Accordingly, I don't feel that the decision to dismiss a case or drop charges should be done via motion. Rather, it should be a discretionary feature of the executive branch. To the extent that it is still done by motion, a judge does retain the legal authority to grant or reject it, but in these particular cases, I believe, should accede to the Department of Justice's decisions. But I'm open to discussion on the topic, and if anyone would like to raise a counterpoint, you can reach me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com or through my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I'm happy to have a debate on the merits of these arguments. I think they're fascinating. What I'm not willing to do is entertain a political discussion of how awful President Trump is for pardoning him, or how since Sullivan was appointed by a Democrat, he was really just trying to go after a Trump guy. Partisan political discussions seeking to cast an opposition as nefarious based on their affiliation rarely set forth productive material. And I'd prefer to talk about the interesting legal debate which takes place here rather than engage in ad hominem attacks. Well, that's the show. I do apologize for it going a little longer than usual, but there was a lot to unpack here, and I really didn't want to give these interesting legal concepts short shrift. I'd like to send a special thank you to my brother, Dan Townsend, for the amazing intro and outro music for this podcast. As always, I'm Paul Townsend. You've been listening to In Summation, The Final Word. Thanks so much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.